This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me a great writer, Michael Perry. His latest book is called simply Coop, as in chicken coop, and his previous works included the amazing and heart-wrenching book Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time, and also Truck, A Love Story. Michael Perry, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I love having the writers on the show, so it's a pleasure for me. You weren't always a writer. Tell me about that.
Well, I grew up on a little dairy farm in northern Wisconsin, up by New Auburn, Wisconsin, a town of 485 people, at least it was at the time of the book I wrote. Started working on a ranch in Wyoming when I was 16, then went to college, got a nursing degree. I have a bachelor's degree in nursing. Was working as a nurse quite contentedly and had a friend write a piece about canoeing on the river and sold it to Wisconsin Trails magazine for, I think, at $75 or something like that. And I remember quite naively just saying, oh, I didn't realize you could get paid for writing. And that was naive on a lot of levels. But I went to the library, checked out a copy of The Writer's Market. In the section in the front, there's a thin section that's basically called How to Be a Writer. I read that. I started doing what it said, sending out query letters and trying to get clips. And, you know, it's one of those overnight deals that took 15 years. I started writing copy for a local ad agency. I wrote copy for a local radio station, 30-second used car ads, whatever it took to pay the rent. I was fortunate in that I had a bachelor's degree in nursing, so about half to three-quarters of my income each year I made writing chapters for medical legal textbooks, a real drudgery, but a rent payer. And then fell into the company of poets and started hanging out with some poets, going to poetry readings, fell head over heels in love with poetry and language and the way poets used words. And then that's when I started trying to pursue a word. I'm leery of this word. You have to be careful, but I tried to pursue some art and really then fell in love with poetry, realized I wasn't much of a poet, but fell further in love with the essay form, and that's where it really started for me.
Were there poets you want to name who had a influence?
Sure,
on you?
You bet. Frank Stanford, Sharon Olds. Number one, my favorite of favorites is Dylan Thomas. I just love, you know, I have people say, well, I don't really understand what his poetry means. I don't get it either, but man, it tastes great, doesn't it? And it just, his language is surreal and beautiful and evocative. And he is known for saying that a writer should choose words for their taste over their meaning, which I think is a wonderful concept.
I mean, there is a bucolic aspect of your writing and his. The poem Fern Hill's running through my head right now, as you mentioned.
Oh, so, sure.
And that is a beautiful poem, and I see it reflected in some of your work. Let me go back to you being a nurse. My wife's a nurse, so I'm always interested in nurses. You can't go wrong with nurses, is my motto. But you were a male nurse in a profession that is still extraordinarily lopsided, must be 90-95% female. Tell me about that.
Well, it wasn't any sort of big trauma. There were certainly some issues. My favorite story is that I worked on that ranch in Wyoming every summer, and that's how I put myself through college. I would save my money from working on the ranch and put it toward my tuition. And a little story I like to tell is that I was the only cowboy in all of Wyoming who was putting himself through nursing school. And I based that on some conversations I had around the old Brandon fire. But I was one of three men in a class of 95. The other two gentlemen were older, married, and had served in the military, which is where a lot of male nurses come from, the military. They have some medical training as a medic, and then they come out of the military and go to nursing school. It is my understanding that the numbers have stayed pretty steady at 3-5%. I know when I was in college, I did a little paper on it, and it was 3-5% then, as it had been from the beginning of time. I don't know where the numbers are at today. There were some things. I mean, I had an incident where a psychology professor said that I had sexual identity issues. He said this in front of an entire college class. There was some graffiti on the wall of the tiny little men's locker room in the School of Nursing building. But you know what? I grew up on a farm. My brother's a logger. I was working as a cowboy during the summers. I really wasn't concerned.
That derision that is there in the movie Meet the Fockers, for instance, that didn't really have an effect on you?
I found it recognizable and hilarious. I mean, I think there was some talk that was demeaning. As a male nurse, all the jokes, I'd heard them, they're fair enough, it was funny. And my favorite story about that, my father is a gentle, humble man, hardworking farmer, just the greatest example that I've ever been given. And the night I decided to tell him I wanted to be a nurse, we were walking to the barn to milk the cows after supper. And I wasn't nervous. As I said, he's a gentleman. So I wasn't worried that there's going to be any blow up or anything like that. But I was a 17-year-old male. I was the leading tackler on the football team, you know, so it's a moment. And so I said, Dad, we're partway between the house and the barn. I said, Dad, I want to be a nurse. And he turned, he looked at me, and he said, well, your mother's a nurse. It's a noble profession. I think you'll make a fine nurse. And he turned and started to walk to the barn. Then he stopped, turned back again. He said, there is just one thing. And I said, what's that? He said, I just want to be there when they pin that little white cap on you. And I thought that was hilarious. And that's the sort of thing where you can decide how you're going to react to it. You can get all offended and hurt, or you can say, oh, yeah, fair enough, you know, funny, and move on, yeah.
In your practice as a male nurse, there's a little anecdote in Coop here, Michael Perry, about a woman who was not expecting a male nurse.
Not so much. Well, I was in my maternity rotation, and this poor woman had her baby and then had to have her post-delivery checks, which are extremely personal in nature and require the nurse to visit some of your most intimate geography. And so the instructor had gone in and asked the woman, do you mind if a student nurse does your checks? And she, of course, envisioning some fresh-faced 20-year-old young lady, said, oh, no, that's fine. And in I walked with a mullet, spiked hair, and if it was my junior or senior year, I probably had a mustache as well, what I call the bad hair trifecta. And she took one look at me and said, oh my God. But then, and I don't remember exactly how I tell the story, but she just, I said, well, it's okay. I'll give you the out if you'd rather not. And then she just said something like, I don't remember which kid, but something like this, it's my third kid, go ahead. And she lifted up her gown and I did my duties and left the room.
I'm speaking with Michael Perry, who has that story in his latest book, Coop, which is ostensibly about building a chicken coop, but it's much much bigger than that. It's about life. It's about living in Wisconsin. It's about dealing with tragedy. It's about marriage. And we'll talk about some of that. Let's talk about marriage first, since I brought it up, because your previous book, Population 485, you were so hostile to the idea of getting married. I was shocked to see you married in Coop.
Yeah, I have to call you a little bit on that. I got emails, you know, you used the word hostile, and I got emails and letters from people saying, what do you have against marriage? And I would tell them to go back and read Population 45, because in there I cite my parents, who are now into their fifth decade of a marriage that is wonderful and respectful in every sense. And I made a point in Population of bringing that out and saying that I admired that, but it's also part of what held me back, because any time I was in a relationship and thought, well, I can't have what my folks have, I would bail.
But you also have passages in Population 485 about why in the world would anyone
exactly
do this?
Right. And so in my next book, which was called Truck, A Love Story, I set out to write that book about just resurrecting an old International Harvester pickup truck. It was also a book about gardening. And halfway through the book and in life, I met this woman. And the story is I went to a library and I met a woman. And I have told the American Library Association that they are free to use that quote in all their promotional materials, but they never go for it. And eventually she became my wife. And so in Coop, we are already married and we're moving to this farm, and I'm blessed. I have my wife is more educated than I. She is stronger than I. She is the rock in our relationship. I'm the flighty one. I'm the navel-gazing one. And furthermore, I'm the guy going around the country talking about how I'm raising pigs and chickens and babies while my wife is at home taking care of the pigs and the chickens and the babies.
You've got a line, Michael Perry, in Coop, that talks about the difference between earning and providing.
Yeah, and it's a problem that I face all the time, and I'm not, I don't always make the right decision. I grew up a Wisconsin farm boy, that whole work ethic thing, you just put your head down and go. In Population 485, I think I have a line, something like, people ask me, what's the secret to making a living as a freelance writer? And I tell them I learned everything I needed to know about surviving as a writer from cleaning my dad's calf pens. And that is, you just keep shoveling until you got a pile so big someone has to notice. And I really have approached writing that way. I come from a blue collar background. I serve on a fire department with people who run snow plows, work at the factory, work at the feed mill. They pour concrete. And I just cannot put on airs about what I do. I love writing, but it's a craft, and you get up and you work at it every day. Now, where I run astray sometimes is that I equate working hard with taking care of my family. And there are times when my wife has to say, you know, we appreciate what you're doing for us, but sometimes you need to be at the supper table, or sometimes you just need to sit still and let your children see you, or let me see you.
Just to be there a little more.
Absolutely.
You also write in this book, you've got another line about what it means to be how to succeed as a freelance writer, and that is, the secret is to wake up scared every morning.
Yeah, I love writing to my core. I'm so grateful I discovered it. It came late. I've used the line many times. I feel like a guy who got on the wrong bus, but man, it's a great bus, and I hope I don't have to get off. But I also make no bones about the fact that I've chosen to support myself and my family doing this, and so I am always, I don't deny, I'm in the business of trying to entertain people as well as trying to craft something beautiful. And so part of being self-employed as a writer, especially, you know, to say that the state of publishing is parlous is an understatement. That's why I do a lot of live performance. That's why I've branched into music. I'm doing a lot of different things, but at the core of it is the writing. And the bottom line is, and let me preface this by saying again, I can't say this enough, I am happy, I am grateful, I am blessed to be able to do what I do. But people sometimes ask me, well, where do you get your inspiration? And I say, well, my muse is a little bald-headed guy named Jim, and he sits up the road 9 miles from me at the Chautauqua State Bank, and he holds my mortgage. And if I don't write, he takes my house away. And that's only a little bit of an oversimplification.
Yeah, I'm not a believer in the muse, and I just kind of laugh when people say, writers say they're waiting for the muse to inspire them. I mean, we got to sit down and do the work.
You have flashes where things really come together, but man, you got to have the motor revving.
I was going to say, isn't that in train, in the process of
writing,
where that arrives more often than not, or in the shower?
Where you prove yourself is those days when you got nothing and you write anyway, and you sit down and you hammer through something and you get the rough bones of something constructed.
I do that 3 out of 5 days a week. Yeah, because I got to do a 2-minute commentary every morning, and some at 10:30 and at 10:15 sometimes.
Great motivator, fear.
It does.
Yes.
You mentioned that you branched into music. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Oh, sure, a little bit. I have. I had written about music for years. I go to great lengths to tell you that I am not a musician. I have friends who are musicians. I have people in my band who are musicians, and I respect their talent. But over the years, I'm a binge writer. I tend to write. I write every day. But about 2 or 3 times a week, I'll get into a 12 or 14-hour binge where I'll just write steady, and you get something started, you don't want to shut it off. Nonetheless, you need a little break, and what happened is I started picking up a guitar and working on songs in between, and it's a way to take a break without really turning that part of your brain off. And
Were you musical as a kid?
No. I took piano lessons until I discovered football, and I sang in the choir, I think, in my junior or senior year in high school. I did sing in church every Sunday, so I learned rudimentary harmony and things like that. And I tried to learn just a few chords on the guitar, several false starts, but finally learned a D chord, then I learned an A chord, and then I learned a G, and then, well, there you go, that's what more do you need? And so I just started writing songs, and I had about 20 songs, and a musician friend said we should play out, and so I played a coffee shop. I did about an hour-long set in 32 minutes flat because I was so nervous. But since then, it's become, we do about 10 or 15 events a year, and I just got back from Deadwood, South Dakota. We played a job out there, and sometimes I combine it with the reading. Sometimes I'll do a reading from the book, a humorous presentation, and then I bring out the band, and we play for an hour. But more and more, we're also doing a lot of just straight-up band jobs.
I'm speaking with Michael Perry, now a musician, but also a great writer. His latest book is called Coop. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Is there a different rush performing music on stage than a reading?
Yeah, the one thing I love about music, and I used to always envy musicians this, and now I get to have just a tiny taste of it. Now, I can't improvise. I write the songs. I know a very few limited chords, and if it ain't in 4/4 time, it ain't happening. But I always envied musicians that expression in the instant, the way they could redo a song and just feel the emotion in the moment. Whereas with writing, yes, you get to do readings, but in general, you spend hours and hours and days and weeks refining, trying to get that thing perfect. And then it's somewhat fixed. And what I love about music is just that instant, that thing that's happening live.
The improv aspect of it.
Yeah, and just the feeling you get from that back and forth with the crowd.
I wanted to return to something you said earlier, Michael Perry, about a couple times in our conversation so far about growing up blue collar, because I found in this book, Coop, a hint of criticism about people who refer in a condescending way toward people who are blue collar or who are farmers. There's a romanticization and a condescension there. And you even mentioned one writer who's known for his grittiness who seemed to be stereotyping or condescending to people on a classist basis. Does that really rankle you?
Well, I have to be careful. I can shoot off my mouth too. But yes, I think if you just think that all working class people are noble savages, that's kind of condescending. And the truth is they're as complicated as the rest of us. I think it goes both ways. I think I despair sometimes at the way, I've criticized myself in Population 45 that I was raised, not raised, but over time had become the sort of guy who tends to be dismissive of anything more complicated than a bag of feed. And the truth is we need academics. We need philosophers. What I despair about is that it seems, and perhaps I'm burnishing history here, but it seems there was a time when there was a little more overlap. You could be a farmer and still read the great philosophers. And for whatever reason, there seems to be this separation now where it's intellectuals versus blue collar. Well, shoot, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you today if I hadn't gone to a bar in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Me, a teetotaler who's never had a drop of alcohol, but found a bar in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a college town, where there was a corner where guys who worked in a plastics factory, guys who hung drywall, hung out with the local English professors, and they talked about literature. And a guy like me could just idle up and sit down and listen and have a master class in literature from guys who were wearing steel-toed boots and not just as a fashion statement. So I think I'm fortunate to travel in both circles and see it from both perspectives. But yes, you can oversimplify things. And no one is more guilty of that than me. I mean, I have to watch myself constantly. I'm a knee-jerk guy, and I know that. And I grew up with pickup trucks and gun racks. I have certain predilections. And those are hard to overcome sometimes if they come from your gut rather than your head.
And do you get people sneering at you for being a hunter when you're in the other circle?
I have had some interesting discussions about hunting and the use and ownership of rifles and guns, yes. And I think sometimes I encounter a double standard there, and I tend to be a Second Amendment guy. I think I am not at all interested in waving it around or bragging about it. I think that's dangerous and silly. But I grew up, my deer rifle was a tool. I use it every year. I will use it here in a few weeks. And I feed my family with it.
I'm speaking with Michael Perry, who wrote Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors, One Siren in a Time, which is just a devastating, and at times very entertaining, but devastating at the end about tragedy. And he also wrote Truck, A Love Story, and Coop. Ostensibly about building a chicken coop, but also...
ostensibly, you're right. There's really no coop until, what, chapter 8 or 9 or something like that.
But it's a philosophical book in its own right. It's a book also about tragedy, actually, a tragedy that is in continuity with the tragedy, unbelievably, as it seemed, in Population 485. But there are other tragedies in here. And Michael, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to read at least one passage from Coop when I have writers and poets on. I'd like to let the listener hear the writer's voice as well as try to sample the art and craft of it. So if you wouldn't mind reading a passage, setting it up.
Sure. This is a paragraph written after I've learned about the death of a friend named Ricky. Hadn't seen him for many years, and he and I used to play together as children, and we had a special spot we went to down on the creek. There were these two culverts that went under the road, and we would play down there and play in the ditch water, and we had a hideout down there, and we could hunker down below the roadbed out of sight when we heard cars coming. And he had a tough stretch. He had some time in jail and then died much too young. And so this is just in the wake of his death. You learn not to pretty these things up. You learn to take them as they are. I go to the culverts one day and just sit quiet. Two steel tubes and a half-hearted crick. I guess I could do better for a favorite place. But grandeur is for postcard trips. For the long haul, I want the click and trickle of flat water moving, the shelter of the grass, a road close to home, the chance to slip from sight at the sound of motors. I throw a pebble for Ricky, but I'm not looking for angels in the tag alders. I just watch the creek flow from beneath me and out of sight around the bend. When I was a kid, I yearned to follow that water, on a raft, in a canoe, maybe simply barefoot with a stick. Now I just dangle my boots and let the cold spring air make my nose run, and I watch Beaver Creek slide smooth and quiet until it reoccurs to me that the world is constantly trying to bring everything level.
I just love that passage. That's Michael Perry reading from his latest book called Coop, and it's a passage that is beautiful and tragic and, to my mind, accurate. And its modesty about not prettying things up and enjoying where you are, and there are also evocations of the great novella "River Runs Through It" there in that little passage. So I appreciate you reading that for us, Michael Perry. You know, you're a wonderful writer of place, and this is kind of a writerly English major discussion, but
fun.
You know, you can write from a specific place, in this case, Wisconsin, and yet you can write about the human condition, not to be too heavy on it. But what is the importance for you of writing from this place, and do you envision writing from another place at some point?
Strictly as a writer, I'd love to write from another place sometime. I have talked to my publisher about that, about the idea of doing a book about some place I've never been. It's a possibility. For now, they know what they want. And I love, one of the great joys of what I do is that the very material, the very people I write about, the very area I write about allows me to remain close to the ground. And that's where I feel most comfortable. I'm on the local fire department. We moved to a farm, so we're in a different fire district, but I joined the local service there and making those calls, picking up my neighbors, hoping that they'll pick me up someday if I need it. That keeps everything in perspective. There's also just this great joy of writing about places that are nearby, and that my new book, I'm writing about an old timer, a guy who makes his own cannons and he's 80 years old and living in the house he was born in and has seen this world of change, and how neat that I can just run over to the next valley and spend time with him. And also that there's not artifice. He's a blacksmith, so I have things I need fixed. I can take him over there, and in the process of him fixing, we shoot the breeze. So I think I am most comfortable in rural Wisconsin, and if that be the place I write from forever, so be it.
To what extent does the publisher dictate? It sounds like your publisher's leaning on you to do it one way.
Leaning on me would be a little much, but there, obviously, there's a. They like what they've seen, and so they don't really want to change direction. And I am trying to change direction, but slowly, because I too am content. I sound like such a square when I say this, but I'm deeply grateful. I just never ever set out to do this, and the fact that I'm in studio shooting the breeze about books with you is a great privilege, and I could be many other places.
Yeah, I feel privileged too, so I thank you for being here. You know, Michael Perry, you've got a line in your latest book, Coop, that I wanted you to elaborate on. You talk about your mindset. You say you have a low-key doomsday mindset about the future. Well, it's funny in one way to have a low-key mindset about doomsday, because I would think it would be a higher key or a louder decibel anyway. But tell me about that and perhaps what that means about returning to a more self-sufficient community, which is what you've been talking about.
Well, I already talked about living close to the ground. I just I grew up in a circumstance, a large, loving family, but we didn't have much. And I never went to bed hungry. I would never plead poverty or anything like that. But we lived close to the ground. And all my years, as a, 20 years now as a volunteer firefighter and EMT, I see how quickly things can be taken from you, no matter who you are. And so I just try to run close to the ground, literally and figuratively. It's why I walked to the studio today, so I wore some walking shoes, but just about always I wear boots. And the reason I wear boots is because I always feel like if things go to heck, you want to have a good pair of boots on. And so when I say I have a low-key doomsday, I think part of that's just the whole Midwestern Scandinavia thing. You go, oh, things are really going to heck, but let's not make a scene. And that's kind of how I go. But I do think there are obviously many things to be concerned about. And since I'm not the type to make a scene or to holler, I've just decided I'm going to get some pigs, get some chickens, going to hang out with the old timer, learn about the blacksmithing. I'm not saying that I'm going to need to know how to make my own horseshoes in 10 years, but I'm glad I got my own pork chops in my backyard. And so that's my low-key approach. And I'm no good at hectoring or haranguing anybody either. I'm a Reformed fundamentalist Christian. So my way is you just do your thing, and if someone notices, that's nice, but I'm not going to push anybody.
Well, Michael Perry, a lot of people are noticing you for your writing, and I'm just wondering, does that ever get to your head, or do you ever, how do you deal with that?
My wife and my family is very good at reminding me exactly who I am, exactly what my real responsibilities are. And I think I can say with some confidence that because of those important people in my life, no, it doesn't go to my head. I am low level nervous all the time about losing this. And so we all have our days, and there's ego involved, or you wouldn't put pen to paper. I'm very upfront about that. But I can tell you that when I was up before at dawn yesterday fixing the chicken fence, and then before I drove down here for this interview, I fixed the pig fence. Mm-hmm. So that helps, I think.
I mean, that ego can be crippling too, though. Can be paralyzing.
Yeah, if you believe your own stuff, bad or good. You know, I get reviews. Some are good, some are bad. And you can let the bad ones ruin you or the good ones ruin you in a different way. So I'm just happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy you've been here for this past half hour. Michael Perry is the author of Coop and also of Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time, which is also an incredible book, and Truck, a Love Story, which I have to admit I haven't read yet, but I might go out and grab pretty soon. You can find out more about Michael Perry at sneezingcow.com. I'm Matt Rothschild. You've been listening to Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.